This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Neil Conan is on assignment. On Saturday, Benjamin Cohen observes the Sabbath. Like other Orthodox Jews, he attends synagogue and follows religious ritual. But for 1 year of his life, Sunday was another story. In the hope of reconnecting with his Jewish faith, Benjamin devoted a year to exploring Christianity. He watched Christian wrestling matches, accompanied Mormon missionaries, even confessed his sins to a Catholic priest. As he describes it, he spent 12 months in a Disneyland of Christianity that he created. He tells the story of that journey in his new book, My Jesus Year, A Rabbi's Son Wanders the Bible Belt in Search of His Own Faith. Benjamin Cohen joins us today. And later in the hour, is American literature really too insular and ignorant to win the Nobel Prize? Two critics weigh in. But first, have you ever explored another faith? And if so, did it strengthen your faith or weaken it? Tell us your story. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And you can comment on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Author Benjamin Cohen joins us now from member station WABE in Atlanta. So good to have you with us.
Good to be here, Lynn. Thank you.
So tell me, how did this whole exploration of Christianity begin? What motivated it?
Well, I think Jews in general are walk around America and as a minority, and we see Christians like around Christmas time, and it looks like they're having so much fun while we're persecuted and have to eat kosher and observe the Sabbath. So I think by nature, Jews fantasize about what it would be like not to be Jewish. In particular, you know, I grew up the son of an Orthodox rabbi, and I was pushed headfirst into the deep end of the Jewish pool, and I was told, you know, do this, do that, without ever being told the reason, you know, why I was doing those things. So for me, I never had that spirituality attached to my religion. It was just a set of laws that I felt that I had to follow. So as I got older and I wanted to make Judaism my own, I decided that I needed to shake things up a bit.
Yeah, and it's interesting, too, that your wife is a convert to Judaism from Christianity. And I had the sense that you kind of wanted to have that feeling that a convert has. You wanted that experience of really the sort of spiritual excitement, I guess, I would say, that a convert has. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. Even not just converts. There are plenty of Jews who grow up not religious and become religious later in life. As a matter of fact, my dad, as a rabbi, he would reach out to these people, and we'd have secular Jews over for Friday night dinner for the Sabbath. And I always looked at them longingly, like this was their first Friday night dinner, and they were able to access Judaism on their own. The same thing with my wife, who converted to Judaism. Everything was something she chose it. And, you know, as Jews, it's the quintessential paradox. We're the chosen people, but what if we don't want to be chosen? And that's what I kind of dealt with growing up.
But why did you think that going out and exploring Christianity would bring you to that point, would renew your sort of interest in your own faith?
Well, I needed to do something. As an Orthodox Jew, I pray three times a day. I keep kosher. I go to synagogue. I keep the Sabbath. So I was already doing all of these things, and I had too much Jewish guilt not to do those things. So I had to find something that would allow me entree into a different spiritual realm and that would give me a fresh perspective of Judaism.
And we should make it clear that you really weren't what is thought of as a seeker, that is someone sort of really looking for a different faith experience possibly. In fact, you continued your practices as an Orthodox Jew, and you even got a rabbi to approve this venture. Now, why did you need that seal of approval?
Well, I grew up across the street from a Methodist church, and I was told that I was never allowed to go in there, like it was a witch's house. And, you know, don't walk up that hill over there to that building. And the Jewish law, strict Jewish law, states that Jews aren't supposed to go into a church, specifically during prayer services. So I knew that if I wanted to go on this mission, the one thing, ironically, that was stopping me from going on this journey was Jewish law, which says I'm not allowed to go into church. So, as well as my wife, who, you know, she was still dripping wet from the conversion waters, and here I was saying, hey, by the way, I want to take a look at Christianity. She was making moves on Moses, and I was still jonesing for Jesus. So I had to get a rabbinic approval for all this. So I actually spoke to a bunch of rabbis and found a couple, actually, Orthodox rabbis who said I could go on a couple conditions. They said, first of all, it's an educational thing. We know you're not going to convert. And he gave me two conditions on going. Number one, I had to wear my Jewish skull cap at all times so that people knew I was Jewish. And number two, I had to wear my press pass so that people knew I was an observer and not there to pray.
You a couple of times referred to yourself as an anthropologist, that you were visiting some of these churches and having some of these experiences with Christianity, really as not even just as a journalist, but as an anthropologist in a way.
Yeah, I felt like a fly on the wall at a lot of these churches. You know, I live here in the Bible Belt, and, you know, I pass, there's more churches on street corners here than Starbucks, and I pass by them all the time, never knowing what goes on inside. I think a lot of people drive, you know, don't know what's going on, and there's so many, you know, within different denominations, different things go on inside. So for me, it was truly an exploration of all these different cultures that live right here in my own city.
We are talking with Benjamin Cohen about his book, My Jesus Year, A Rabbi's Son Wanders the Bible Belt in Search of His Own Faith. And we want to hear from you if you've ever had an experience where you have looked into another faith. Did it strengthen your own religious beliefs or did it change them or weaken them in any way? Give us a call. The number is 800-989-8255. You can also send an email to talk@npr.org. So, let's talk about some specific examples. You were saying that you had to indicate that you were Jewish, and you opened the book with this pretty funny description of you at a gigantic megachurch and seeing yourself suddenly up on this big screen. Maybe you can describe what was happening there.
Sure. I figured if I'm going to go to church, I might as well jump into the deep end. So the first church I went to was the New Birth Baptist Megachurch in Lithonia, Georgia, which, if I recall correctly, is the 13th largest church in America. And they have about 22,000 members there. And the Sunday I was there, they had about 15,000 people were there. You have to keep in mind, the synagogues I go to are lucky to have 25 people in them. So this was a real culture shock for me. And so I went in there, and I have a friend, a coworker who I work with, who actually attends this church, and she apparently told him I was coming. So when I got there, at the beginning of services, they announced that I was there. We'd like to welcome our Jewish friend, Benjamin Cohen. I think that was the first time I've ever had the word Jewish friend attached to my name. they have, you know, all these video cameras swooping around getting pictures of congregants. And so the cameras came in on me, and there I was, my Jewish face on Jesus' Jumbotron, two big Jumbotrons in front of the whole church.
It kind of scared you, didn't it?
It was. I guess you can call it baptism by fire. It was really an interesting way to kick off the whole year. But to my surprise, everyone, you know, the second they heard I was there, I was a Jewish journeyman, you know, seeking out spirituality, they all came. Everyone gave me a little hug, and, you know, they're kind of bridging the gap, maybe a little too closely, between our two religions.
Yeah. Let's take a call now. We're going to go to Jan, and she is calling from Hilton Head Island, South Carolina. Hi, Jan.
Well, hello, and Lashana Tova. It's just past our new year. And I did want to say that over the years, I embraced a lot of different religions. I was born Jewish, and I was actually first introduced to Christianity because I wanted to work for Chuck Colson's prison effort, and they insisted that I read the New Testament, and then it turned out that they wanted to save prisoners for Jesus, and I wasn't quite ready to take that kind of leap of faith, but I did appreciate the fact that I was getting an exposure to Christianity, and I think that God has presented truth in many different ways to many different people, and I think it behooves us to investigate goodness and religion as a shining light and a way to inspire us in our lives. I really appreciate the fact that the Christian right has really started embracing Israel more so nowadays. I used to feel very persecuted by the religious right, and I feel now more of a sense that they're opening their arms and such. And it's my personal plan to, I'm a massage therapist currently, but I'm planning on going back to school because I would like to become a rabbi. In fact, my daughter is currently in Israel.
Interesting.
Right now, but yeah. But I think that if we see, in the 60s, the idea of one world was the idea that people should look at the fact that they're more alike than they are different and try to embrace as much as possible other people's thoughts and feelings, and part of that being their religion, which I think is just a way of helping to shape your life.
All right. Well, thanks so much for your call, Jan.
Thank you. Bye-bye now.
Interesting perspective what Jan was talking about. And one thing I wanted to ask you, Benjamin, and am I pronouncing your name correctly? You said it a little bit differently, I think. Benjamin.
It's Benjamin. It's Benjamin.
Benjamin
with a Y.
Okay, Benjamin.
Yeah. Either way is fine.
What I was wondering was, by approaching this sort of from this anthropological point of view and as a journalist, do you think that in some ways it kept you from fully exploring different forms of Christianity in a deep way, that it kept you a little bit on the surface?
Well, as a journalist by nature, I'm a cynic. So I think that was, you know, certainly a stumbling block during the course of this year. At the same time, I knew I was not going to be leaving Judaism. So that again, I guess, was a stumbling block. But besides that, you know, I did try to open myself up to spiritual growth. And, you know, obviously I was not going to convert to Christianity. I didn't have any intentions of converting to Christianity. So I was going with my journalist notepad in hand. And the first few times I went to church, it was much more of that. But as the year went on and I started hanging out with, besides going to churches, I hung out with Christians one-on-one a lot, especially with my wife's family who are partly evangelical Christians. And that, to me, was the more meaningful stuff that happened during the year.
Yeah. And, of course, you experienced Christmas, and I want to get into that in more detail. We're going to have to take a small break. But I think you had a little bit of an epiphany or a little bit of a moment of realizing the difference between, the Christmas that's all about the nutcracker and the Christmas tree and what Christmas is really about. So we're going to get into a little bit more of those kinds of experiences that you had during your year when we return from a short break. Our guest is Benjamin Cohen, the author of My Jesus Year, A Rabbi's Son Wanders the Bible Belt in Search of His Own Faith. If you'd like to give us a call, the number is 800-989-8255. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Lynn Neary. Right now, we're talking with Benjamin Cohen. His new book is titled My Jesus Year, A Rabbi's Son Wanders the Bible Belt in Search of His Own Faith. And of course, we want to hear from you. Have you ever explored a religion other than your own? And did it bring you closer to your faith or push you away? Give us a call at 800-989-8255 or send us an email to talk@npr.org. And Benjamin, I was talking to you about Christmas just before the break, and that was interesting because you kind of went into that wanting to just, you know, throw yourself into everything, got into an argument with your wife over getting a Christmas tree even. But that at the end, you realized you kind of were left feeling like it hadn't been everything you'd wanted it to be.
Sure. I think I say in the book I had a Christmas hangover.
Right.
I spent from Thanksgiving forward, I spent my days immersing myself in the mass market commercialization of what we call in America, you know, Christmas season. And so I went to the mall and I bought gifts, and I went to the Nutcracker. I bought eggnog, kosher eggnog, of course. I went to a tree lighting service. I did all these things because those were the tangible things that I saw growing up and even as an adult, that this is what Christianity was about. It was all about this pomp and circumstance. So I wanted to, for once, just be a part of that. And what I discovered when I woke up Christmas morning was I felt empty inside. It was all tangible things. It wasn't anything internal. It wasn't anything spiritual.
Right. And what did that insight sort of teach you ultimately?
You have to be Christian to enjoy Christmas. I think that's really what I learned.
Did you get any insight into the spirituality of Christmas or the religious meaning of Christmas at all?
A little bit. I mean, just from experiencing it, just from seeing other people experiencing it, whether it was my wife's family or I went to a midnight mass service and I saw the beauty of that service. But for me, I was never going to be able to enjoy it the way they were enjoying it. And I think it was an important lesson for me that as much as I want to put a costume on and pretend to go through these motions, it's never going to inculcate itself within me.
All right, let's take a call now. We're going to go to Karuna, who's calling from Sonoma County, California. Hi, Karuna.
Hello. Thank you so much for this show. It's really fascinating. I'm a Jewish convert. I converted about 5 years ago after I was ordained as an interfaith minister. I grew up Catholic, and I chose Judaism because of some of the requirements for my ordination. And what I discovered in my journey to Judaism, I converted to Reconstructionist Judaism, which is different than Orthodox. But in my journey, what I discovered was I was able to heal some of my own Catholic wounds in my studies. And I had a particularly pivotal moment at a Yom Kippur service at the very end, at the Ne'ilah service, where I actually felt for the first time in my life that I was forgivable. I was not this horrible person that had to supplicate myself all the time, which is what I felt in Catholicism, in the Catholic faith and in the Mass. You know, I am not worthy to receive you is repeated over and over again. And when I came to Judaism, I had a very different experience, and especially the Reconstructionist movements as well. So I can really appreciate what you were trying to do with your own journey.
All right. Thank you. Thanks so much for your call, Karuna.
Thank you.
And I want to read an email to you, Benjamin. This is from Carrie from Rochester, New York. As a teenager, I began questioning my native religion of Catholicism and exploring other religions, Protestantism, Wicca, Buddhism, Hinduism. As I learned, I slowly discovered that each was equally valid and that none were particularly convincing. Over time, I realized that practitioners of any religion pick and choose what to retain or believe and what to discard. This selectively made me realize that I couldn't genuinely commit to any. Now, years later, I'm a complete and total atheist. Did your guest have any similar experiences?
That's an excellent question. Like I said earlier on, I grew up in the belly of Jewish life. And we had a synagogue. My dad actually built a synagogue attached to our house. So we had services there every Saturday. So for me, it was so ingrained in my being, my very being, that I don't really think I had that choice to not be Jewish. I think the choice for me was, how do I live with this Judaism in a way that's spiritually fulfilling for me?
Yeah. Here's a letter. Here's an email from Catherine. She's writing from Jacksonville, Florida. I was raised a Christian and married an Israeli man. I studied about Judaism first for him and then for myself. I fell in love with Judaism and I love everything about it. However, I have never been able to shake the belief that Jesus is in some way the Son of God and have lately gone back to church. I think this has weakened my faith and strengthened it. I can't really follow either religion totally, but it has strengthened it so that I have a much deeper faith with many facets to it. What's your reaction to that, Benjamin? The idea that, she's feeling a little bit alienated from both faiths, but on the other hand feels that she has a deeper faith with many facets.
I think there's two aspects. Number one, there's spirituality, and to access spirituality in today's society, I think there are many avenues that we can use to access that. So whether it's through different religions, but for religion, whether it's Christianity or Judaism or Mormonism or Islam, it requires a commitment, and that's something I think that's crucial in order to access religion. But spirituality can be accessed in many different ways.
All right, let's take a call now from Scott, and Scott is calling from Ypsilanti, Michigan. Hi, Scott.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm good.
Thank you for taking my call. Contrary to Mr. Cohen's experience, I am the son of a Presbyterian minister. And while I grew up within the church and within the faith, my father always encouraged me to seek out other faiths and to find my own. And what I found myself over time, starting from when I was about 15 and I'm 35 now, you know, and having explored Islam and Judaism and other sorts of Protestant religions and Catholicism and even the old religions from the Celtic world, modernly known as witchcraft, is there are grains of truth throughout all of them, even including Buddhism and Taoism. And these principles are that, you know, whether it's the message of Yahweh or the message of Christ or Muhammad, is that we have an obligation to each other to treat each other as equals and to respect the world that we live in, and that while there may or may not be this individual that exists that is omniscient and omnipotent, there is an element of divinity simply in existence. And what I found is that I actually left the Christian faith and left all faith in general, and my own path, which I would describe as a modern pagan, is to pick and choose principles from these different faiths that I am comfortable with and that resonate with me, and to create my own traditions. And it's really turned out wonderfully.
So I was
wondering if your guest had a similar experience. And I will happily take my comments on the air.
Thanks so much for that, Scott. It's interesting to hear the spiritual journey you've been on for your whole life. I think it's somewhat different from what you've been through, Benjamin. But that's also because you really didn't set out to. You set out to explore Christianity for different reasons, it sounds like.
Yeah, I didn't set out to find the things that I liked about Christianity and start practicing those things. I wanted to find out why Christians, it seemed to me, were so excited about the religion. I grew up at a synagogue where people, everything is done by rote, and people come and they shuffle in and they're checking their BlackBerry and they're doing all these other things except talking to God. And so I wanted to be able to see how other people access God and how other people access spirituality, and take that part of it and bring it back and strengthen my own Judaism.
Now, interesting, because, you went to some events like, Christian wrestling, things like that. I think at one point you said you went through a sort of Disneyland of Christianity that you had made up, a Jesus theme park. But the experience that really, I think, maybe had one of the biggest effects on you was actually going to confession the way a Catholic would. And in order to do that, of course, you had to lie. But you did go to confession, and that seemed to have a pretty – how did that affect you?
Well, all the other places I went to, like you said before, I was kind of an anthropologist just sitting in the corner taking notes. And I was one person in a room of many. But with confession, it was literally I had an audience of one. And so it was very hard for me to hide from myself and from the priest that I was talking to. It was probably one of the most nerve-wracking experiences I had during the year, which may be one of the reasons I saved it for the end of my journey. And like you said, I did have to fib a little bit, because I found out that only Catholics are allowed to go to confession. So I went with a Catholic friend of mine, and we stood in line, and we went into confession. And I mean, I was sweating bullets, and I didn't know what to say. That was, I had thought about this for so long. When I finally got into the confession booth, I had forgotten the most important part of a confession. I had forgotten to come up with a sin. So I was kind of speechless at the time.
Mm-hmm. In the end, you did come up with some sins, so to speak, and we will. Although you write about it, we don't necessarily have to go into it here. But ultimately, what was the insight that you brought out of that confessional booth with you?
Well, the priest actually gave me some really prescient advice. He said, you got to go to services, even if you don't want to. You got to go, and you got to go often. I mean, he didn't realize I had been going to multiple services every week. But there's a phrase in Hebrew. There's a called Shelo Lishma Balishma, which means if you do things for the wrong reason, eventually you'll do them for the right reason. And I think that's kind of what the priest was telling me. You go to services, even if you don't want to go to services, even if you're too lazy, you don't want to wake up, just go. Eventually, it'll rub off on you. It'll have an effect on you. And if you keep going and keep going, it'll incorporate itself in you, and you'll enjoy it on a spiritual level, which up until that point I really hadn't been doing. So I think he gave me some good advice.
Okay, we're going to go to Henry in East Lansing, Michigan next. Hi, Henry.
Yes.
Hi, go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. I grew up in Mexico as a Jewish, but my background was more like cultural Jew. My parents claimed to be atheists, and I remember as a small kid feeling I did not live in the Jewish community, so I was surrounded by Catholics, and I felt kind of that I didn't belong there. So I would tag along with all my friends to church, and pretend that I was Catholic, just to belong there. Not because I don't really think that I ever felt any emptiness. I think my parents brought me up to understand that there is a spiritual life that isn't linked necessarily to organized religion, and we were very proud Jews from the cultural point of view. But I was totally in love with the iconography that we did not have in the Jewish tradition, because in the Jewish, you know, in a synagogue, the representational aspect is not there.
Yeah.
And I thought it was interesting to, you know, to wonder, sort of, I did feel like I was incognito or like a voyeur.
Mm-hmm.
I would look at, you know, everybody else and what they did, and I would mimic what they were doing.
I knelt. It sounds similar to what Benjamin went through, I think. Thanks so much for your call, Henry. Dissimilar from your own experience, Benjamin, it sounds like.
No, not at all.
Kind of fascination with Christianity.
I think voyeur is a good way to put it. I went to a Christian retail trade show where they were having, you know, this is iconography in the mundane sense of it. You know, they had Christian dolls and toys and all those kinds of things, and I was very, very jealous of that and wish I had that growing up. The truth is they have all these Old Testament toys. It was another thing I learned during the year was how fascinated Christians are with the Old Testament. I never realized that. I thought it was just the New Testament. So I'm walking around the floor of this trade show, and there's a Moses figurine and a Samson doll and a Noah's Ark board game and all these things. There's no reason why we couldn't sell that stuff in a Judaica gift shop.
I just want to remind our audience that you are listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And here's an email. This email is from Paul, and he says, how did your guest spend Good Friday and Easter during his experience?
Well, Easter, I tried to squeeze as much as I could into Easter. I don't know if your listeners are familiar with, there's a civil Confederate memorial here in Georgia called Stone Mountain, which is one of the largest pieces of exposed granite in the world. It's kind of like a Mount Rushmore kind of thing. And they have sunrise Easter services on top of that mountain, which is kind of strange to have a Confederate memorial. And it was actually at one point in history the base of locations for the Ku Klux Klan. But here it is on Easter morning and sunrise, you know, as the sun is rising, everyone is trekking up the mountain and having services up there. So I did that, and then I went to one of the largest Easter services in the country is held at the Georgia Dome, and they had about over 50,000 people there celebrating Easter. So I had two different kinds of experiences on Easter. I don't think I did anything for Good Friday because the sun was setting and I had to start taking in the Jewish Sabbath.
All right, let's get one more call in. Let's go to Chana, and she's calling from Cleveland. Hi, Chana.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm an Orthodox Jew. I just wanted to ask Benjamin. I'm a little confused. He knew he was going to stay Jewish. He wasn't looking to convert. So why not look within his own religion for more spirituality if that's what he felt he was lacking?
That's a good question. I grew up with all this spirituality around me, and I went to Israel, and I have rabbis in my family. All my siblings are rabbis, and I learn with rabbis. I still learn every week, Jewish stuff. It wasn't doing it for me, so it wasn't a lack of trying. I had tried my entire life to get spirituality out of that, and it just wasn't working. At the same time, I had always been jealous of Christianity, and I think that was a stumbling block in my spiritual growth, that if I didn't get that out of the way, I never would be able to spiritually mature. So it was kind of, I wanted to tackle that and be able to, no pun intended, to cross it off my list.
Did it work?
It did work.
Yeah.
It did work, absolutely. My family's very appreciative that it worked. My converted wife is very appreciative that it worked. I look at Judaism with fresh eyes now. I realize that the grass is not greener at the church across the street. And it made me appreciate Judaism in a fresh new way that I never would have been able to do. I'm not recommending all the people try this at home. You know, each person is different. But for me, it was a very spiritually uplifting year.
All right. Thanks so much for your call, Chana. And thanks to you, Benjamin. Benjamin's book is called My Jesus Year, and Benjamin Cohen is the founder and editor of American Jewish Life and the online magazine Jews Week. He joined us from WABE, our member station in Atlanta. So good to talk with you, Ben.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
And up next, the Transatlantic Literature War. Is American writing really too insular and ignorant for the Nobel Prize? Stay with us. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. On Thursday, the Nobel Prize for Literature will be awarded, but it's not likely that any American authors will be waiting expectantly for word that they've won. That's because last week, Nobel official Horace Engdahl made it clear he does not think much of American literature. Engdahl called Europe the center of the literary world, saying the U.S. is too isolated, too insular, and that Americans don't translate enough and don't really participate in the big dialogue of literature. Needless to say, his comments were not well received stateside. We'll be talking about this transatlantic literary flap with a couple of American writers and critics in a moment. But first, which American author do you think deserves to win the Nobel Prize for Literature and why? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. You can also comment on our blog. It's at npr.org/blogofthenation. And joining us now from our bureau in New York is Adam Kirsch. He's a book critic and the author of a new biography of Benjamin Disraeli. He wrote about Horace Engdahl's comments in a piece called Nobel Gas, The Swedes Have No Clue About American Literature, that appeared in Slate. Adam, thanks for being with us.
Thanks very much.
Okay, so the Swedes have no clue about American literature. Why do you say that, for starters?
Well, there's a little bit of righteous indignation that I think all American writers and readers would have after hearing the comments of Horace Engdahl. But I actually thought that this was a good instance of something that clarifies. The journalist Michael Kinsley once said that a gaffe isn't when you say something by mistake. It's when you accidentally say something that you really think. And in this case, I think that that sort of a gaffe is what we've heard from the Swedes. If you look back over the history of the Nobel Prize, their record at picking the best American writers is pretty poor. Most of the writers who they have picked as the best American writers, or at least many of them, we would no longer say are the ones that we want representing us to the world. And in fact, in the last 30 years, there's been only one American writer awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature. So it might be that what we're finally learning is that American writers have to secede from the Nobel Prize, not expect they're going to win it.
Yeah. Well, and I should say that was Toni Morrison that you just referred
yes.
to, who won the Nobel Prize, and John Steinbeck was another. And so these are writers that you don't think are as good as some of the writers they've overlooked, is what you're saying.
Well, I wouldn't include Toni Morrison in that category necessarily, but if you look a little further back at John Steinbeck or Pearl Buck or Sinclair Lewis, who are some of the writers who won the prize in the earlier part of the 20th century. Those are all writers who now you would be most likely to find on a junior high school reading list. They're not the ones who we think of as the glories of American literature. There are some great American writers who have won the prize, including Faulkner and Hemingway and T.S. Eliot, if you count him as an American, although he had lived in England for many years when he won. But in the last, say, 50 years, the well runs pretty dry. There's been Saul Bellow, Toni Morrison, and that's about it for the last half century.
Yeah. And of course, American writers also love to point out some of the other non-American writers who've been overlooked, like, James Joyce, for instance, Proust.
That's right. There's always a popular pastime of making the list of people who didn't win when people who you've never heard of did win. You could put Nabokov on that list. If you look at American writers looking outside of fiction, Robert Frost, Robert Lowell, Edmund Wilson, those are all people who would have been very natural fits on the Nobel list and never won.
And you also, in your piece, talk about the fact that this attitude on the part of many Europeans really, there's a history to it. It dates back a long way.
It does. I think if you look back at the kind of writing that the Nobel Prize used to honor when it came to American writing, again, looking at people like Steinbeck or Buck, it's not very sophisticated. It tends to be very simple realism and with a strong element of social protest or social criticism. I think that fits in with what the Nobel Prize Committee used to want from American literature. If you ask why haven't any American writers won in the last several decades, I don't think you could possibly say it's because American literature isn't as good as other world literatures. There's something political going on there. It used to be during the Cold War that the Nobel Prize was often given to Soviet writers in order to rebuke the Soviet regime, like Solzhenitsyn or Pasternak. I think that now the prize might be withheld from American writers because there's a strong turn against the United States among European writers and readers.
And joining us now, also from our New York Bureau, is Liesl Schillinger. She's a regular contributor to the New York Times Book Review and a books columnist for the Style section. Good to have you with us.
Hello.
So do you think there's any truth to the criticism that American writers are too insular?
No, I think it's really a little bit hypocritical, or maybe the word is blind. I do a lot of translation, a lot of work with literatures around the world, and to say that our literature is more insular and narrow than other countries just doesn't reflect reality out there. But as an example, I've recently been to Germany looking for books that could be translated that would appeal to the American audience, and many of them really are far too particular to what to German taste in literature. On the other hand, I would say that the narrowness of a book, the narrowness of its subject, doesn't mean it can't also be universal. You know, if you think of some of the books that have been best loved in the last decade, you've got The Death of Vishnu. That takes place on a stairway in Bombay. You've got also The Kite Runner. That's in Afghanistan. That's a young boy's experience. The whole point of literature is that it does not need to be blatantly borderless to have universal appeal. In narrowing down, you can really magnify a shareable facet of the human experience.
How do you explain this disdain for American literature that was expressed?
Well, as Adam was hinting, I do think that there is a real resentment of our politics, which has bled into their attitudes towards our literature, acting like we're... You know, I think the impression that the Americans are too big for their britches has fostered some kind of resentment. But one thing that is funny is, you know that book, The Plot Against America, Philip
mm-hmm.
Roth?
Right.
It's kind of nice to know that maybe there is a plot. You know, maybe, as Nixon said, maybe paranoids do have enemies. And we can maybe take their recommendations with a grain of salt and not think that this has to mean this is the best literature out there, but just this is the literature they've selected, which they find worthy. And they don't always make such horrendous mistakes. There's a list of fine, fine books and writers, if you look down everyone they've awarded. But let's not forget that they passed over Tolstoy. And so you have to ask sometimes to yourself, really, what are they looking for?
Okay. If you'd like to join our discussion about the Nobel Prize for Literature and America's role or non-role in it, give us a call at 800-989-8255. We're going to take a call now from Sean. And Sean's calling from Napa, California. Hi, Sean.
Hi. I have a comment. I actually do agree with the Nobel Prize committee member. I think American literature has slipped in recent years. I actually spent several years living in Spain, and I read a lot of Spanish literature in Spanish, and I was pretty struck by the quality, the very high quality of Spanish literature. And also, it seems to me that we have an art system in America, you have to become a bestseller before your book is taken seriously, whereas in Europe, oftentimes the writers gain prominence by winning literary prizes within literary circles.
All right. Thanks for your call, Sean. And let me ask our guests, I mean, do either of you, Adam or Liesl, do you think this is a moment for self-reflection on the part of America's writers at all? Does this...
I profoundly disagree.
Okay. All right.
And one thing is, you know, many you can live abroad, but you don't have to travel abroad to have an understanding, an international understanding and appetite for literature. It is true that Americans don't read, you know, quote, good literature with quite the appetite that some Europeans, notably the Swedes, do. But our writers, in addition, you know, there are groups of our authors who are young and lampoonable in the way that Mr. Engdahl chose to lampoon them. But, you know, what is a rising American author? I mean, you know, who do you count? What about Dinah Mengistu, who came here from Ethiopia? You know, what about Edward Dantegat? What about Jhumpa Lahiri, who came here from England via Bangladesh? You know, this is Khaled Husseini came here from Afghanistan. We are nurturing writers from all over the world and our own writers. And people who find our reading too narrow just have reading lists that are too narrow.
Well, Adam, what do you think the Nobel Committee is looking for in when it nominates a writer or awards the prize in literature?
Well, I wouldn't want to be too cynical or conspiratorial-minded, but if you look at the list of winners of the last decade or so, one thing that they have in common is a strong anti-American political stand. if you look at, for instance, what Harold Pinter said at his Nobel lecture when he won the prize, I believe, in 2005, calling for George Bush and Tony Blair to be prosecuted at the International Criminal Court in The Hague, talking about America's crimes. Doris Lessing, after she won the prize last year, gave an interview in which she said that Americans had made much too much over the September 11th attacks, and they really weren't that big a deal. Günter Grass is on the same end of the political spectrum, Jose Saramago. I think that there is a message being sent there, which is that the Nobel Committee is much more sympathetic to critics of America than representatives of it.
Who would you nominate for a Nobel Prize in Literature?
If I were to pick an American writer, I would say Philip Roth is the natural choice, and he's the one who most American critics in responding to these comments have named, in part because he's obviously one of the greatest writers of his generation and so dominant on the American scene. But also, I think he's a very good refutation of the idea that American literature is insular or parochial. Roth has been very engaged with European, especially Eastern European writers for many decades. His fiction is very experimental at times and also can be very realistic in the American way. For a long time, he was the editor of a series of translations that brought now famous European writers to America who had never been known here before. I think if the Nobel Committee wanted to honor both American and cosmopolitan tendencies, Philip Roth would be the greatest choice.
What about you, Liesl?
Well, I hate to say me too, but I would say he's a shoo-in, but apparently not, you know, and we'll find out Thursday. I mean, I've got lots of favorite writers, but I certainly cannot figure out for the life of me what the Nobel Committee's criteria are. You know, they long ago they overlooked Twain and Dreiser. Who do we have? We've had John Updike. We've had Don DeLille, Paul Auster. There are so many people who are so prolific and so various. I'm not going to, I don't think that they're looking for my opinion right now anyway, though.
Okay. And I just want to remind our audience that you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're going to take a call now. We're going to go to Mitch, and he's calling from Illinois. Hi, Mitch.
Hi. I'm going to unfortunately have to say me three for Philip Roth, which was why I called in. But I think he exemplifies what Liesl said, this intense focus on the particular in his, you know, sense, Newark and the Jewish American environment there, but then the way he universalizes it and just expands these characters into this kind of intensely reflective discourse that's got to be significant everywhere, even though it's embodied in this very, limited community. I mean, that's what literature does, right?
All right. Thanks for your call, Mitch.
Okay.
Thanks for your nomination. Let's go to David, who is calling from Rockford, Illinois. Hi, David.
Hi. I wanted to say that I think John Updike was a glaring omission. I'm a dual citizen from with the U.S. and with Sweden, and I think that the sort of bourgeois existence that Updike writes about with its kind of vacuous pitfalls and emptiness, I mean, I think in large part that is the Western European experience now. And I mean, I think that's what my aunts and uncles in Sweden, they sort of emulate that sort of northeastern upscale existence. So I disagree with the Nobel Committee member who says that it's in American literature is insular, because I think in large part that is the Western European experience.
All right. Thanks for your call, David.
Thank you.
I have a question here from a listener. Phil in Cincinnati, Ohio, writes, why hasn't Joyce Carol Oates ever won a Nobel Prize? Do either of you have an answer to that question?
Well, I think she's one of the people who's a perpetual contender. Whenever there's a discussion of this every year, Roth, Updike, Joyce Carol Oates seem to be the names that are always on the list.
I think that also people tend to be critical of writers who are so prolific that the effort that they expend seems to others too quick. I think she's written a lot, and that's diminished her stock, and that's unfair. She writes under pen names. Everything she publishes everything she writes gets published. This woman has a gift, and I think it has been scanted, been overlooked, and unfairly unrecognized, although she's certainly gotten her share of recognition.
Yeah. We have an email from Tim in Charlottesville, Virginia. I see a dwindling depth and content and creativity in literature. in general, possibly based as much on what publishers seem willing to publish as what writers are trying to get published, but I have just finished Cormac McCarthy's The Road. It's the most profound and serious and tragic and beautiful novel I've read in years, a rare work of art, in my opinion. So there is a vote for Cormac McCarthy.
On my long list.
He was on your long list. You know, ultimately, how important is the Nobel Prize to American writers? There are other, you know, there's the National Book Awards here. There's the Pulitzer Prize, you know, the Penn Prizes. Does it matter to them, do you think?
An interesting thing I saw in the just barrage of articles that have come out this weekend in all of our American indignation is that the Nobel Prize actually doesn't translate into increased book sales, unlike the Pulitzer, unlike the National Book Award. So at least in the simple bottom line value, I guess it's not great, but this is something that is a lifetime honor, though, and writers understandably would like a fair bid for it.
Yeah. Wouldn't it be surprising if Roth won it this year?
That would be a great joke if they had planned this all in advance to mislead people, and then they did give it to Roth.
Yeah. Let's take one more call from Bella in Tucson, Arizona. Hi, Bella.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I would like to recommend Native American writers, in particular Leslie Marmon Silko. I think her novel Ceremony is the most brilliant novel ever written, bar none. I'm surprised that your speakers can talk about writers from all over the world who come here to the U.S. but ignore the indigenous writers of our own country. And I think they have a lot to say, and I'm even disappointed that the Nobel Prize Committee won't consider, or maybe they have, but that they would rule them out when they made the blanket statement that they made.
All right. Well, thank you for bringing that to our attention, Bella.
Thank you.
I don't know if either of you want to comment on that, Liesl?
Well, that does bring to mind a couple of things to me. And one is we need to remember that saying that our writing is American is not something we should regard as a slam. People the world over love the Americanness of our writing. And for Mr. Engdahl to pretend that isn't the case is false and is misleading.
All right,
of James Fenimore Cooper, Twain, yeah. London.
Thanks to both of you for joining us today. Liesl Schlesinger is a regular contributor to the New York Times Book Review, and Adam Kirsch is a book critic and the author of a new biography on Benjamin Disraeli, and they both joined us from our bureau in New York. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington.